I'm Montse Alvarado. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly. Moving ahead, President Joe Biden addresses the nation and the Trump team begins its transition to the White House. No win situation. Ballots continue to be counted in some states as the balance of power on Capitol Hill remains uncertain. We have the latest. Definition of marriage. A closer look at the ballot measures in three states that targeted the family. Plus, answering the call. It's National Vocations Week, and a religious sister tells us about her daily life working for God. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. I'm Montse Alvarado in for Tracy Sable. Our top story tonight. President Joe Biden makes his first remarks since the presidential election, telling people, we accept the choice the country made. He praised Vice President Kamala Harris's character and campaign, and he promised his staff would work with President-elect Donald Trump, who won the election resoundingly, to ease the transition leading up to Inauguration Day. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen, good to see you.
Monse, good evening to you. I was in the Rose Garden earlier today when President Biden made his remarks. The president says on January 20th, we'll have a peaceful transfer of power here in America. The president also acknowledged for some, this is a time of victory, and for others, a time of loss.
President Joe Biden delivers a message to the American people saying, you can't love your country only when you win, and you can't love your neighbor only when you agree.
Setbacks are unavoidable. But giving up is unforgivable.
The president says campaigns are contests of competing visions, delivering his remarks while members of his administration in attendance looked on. His remarks follow former President Donald Trump's victory Tuesday over Vice President Kamala Harris.
Yesterday, I spoke with President-elect Trump to congratulate him on his victory. And I assured him that I'd direct my entire administration to work with his team to ensure a peaceful and orderly transition. That's what the American people deserve.
Even though voters made it clear the economy was their number one concern, Biden pointed to his legislation, including infrastructure investments just kicking in now that will help Americans now and years into the future.
We're leaving behind the strongest economy in the world. I know people are still hurting, but things are changing rapidly.
Later in the White House press briefing room, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre responded to this week's election results.
This was not the outcome that our team had wanted. So are we disappointed? Yes, we are disappointed. It would be false for me to say that we were not.
Meanwhile, President-elect Donald Trump makes plans for a second administration. The president-elect now has to build out his team before Inauguration Day arrives on January 20th. That includes heads of cabinet departments and more.
Now, President Biden also told his cabinet and staff, quote, we have 74 days to finish the term, adding, let's make every day count. And he also said the American experiment endures. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Across the globe, world leaders are offering congratulations to the president-elect. That includes the Vatican's Secretary of State. Cardinal Pietro Parolin said in part, quote, we wish him great wisdom because this is the main virtue of rulers according to the Bible. And it was a good night for Republicans on Tuesday, winning the White House and taking control of the U.S. Senate. But who will have a majority in the U.S. House remains up in the air, with dozens of races yet to be called. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us in our studio tonight with the latest. Eric, it's good to have you in studio.
That's great to be back from Florida. Thank you so much, Monse. Well, I tell you what, the race to control the U.S. House continues with dozens of contests yet to be called. Districts in California, Colorado, and Oregon. Some of the races are separated by just a few hundred points. Republicans think that they will secure by governing a trifecta and keep the House. They add that this will give them a mandate to govern. Many are already talking about priorities that they want to get done.
Donald Trump has a mandate to govern, to address the issues on the economy, on the border, on public safety, and the international crises around the globe. And it looks as though not only are we going to keep the House, but obviously have flipped the Senate.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is so confident Republicans will hold the House, he's already launched his bid to keep his job as Speaker. In a letter to GOP members, he wrote in part, quote, "We can secure our borders, prioritize the needs of Americans above foreigners, promote investment and opportunity through the tax code, return to American energy dominance, dramatically reduce regulations, expand school choice, end the woke agenda, and restore fiscal sanity to Washington." In the wake of the election results, Catholic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, a Michigan Democrat, says her party has some soul searching to do.
We have to respect the integrity of the electoral system, and now we're going to have to work with a new president for the next 4 years and learn what we weren't hearing and why we lost.
In 2016, President-elect Donald Trump became the first Republican to carry the state of Michigan since 1988. If the GOP wins the House, Democrats predict they'll only have a small majority.
It will be yet another term in which whatever party controls the House will not have a very large majority. But I'm confident that whether we're slightly in the majority or slightly in the minority, House Democrats will be able to respond to the needs of the American people.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says he hopes a Republican-controlled Congress will get back to basics.
Doing the basic work of government, which is getting it, deciding how much to spend, and getting it done as close to regular order as possible.
Some races may actually take weeks to get a final result. Now, House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries has called for, quote, every vote to be counted. Members will be back next week for a lame duck session and new member orientation, and then leadership positions will also be voted on. The new Congress will be sworn in on January 3rd to certify the presidential election results. Monse?
Thank you so much, Eric. Well, two seats in the U.S. House just flipped from Democrat to Republican, and both are in the state of Pennsylvania. Rob Bresnahan, a developer, won a district around Scranton Wilkes-Barre, and Ryan McKenzie is a state-level lawmaker who won a district near Allentown. This comes as Donald Trump won the Keystone State in the presidential election. Its 19 electoral college votes are the most of any battleground state. Prior to Election Day, both campaigns visited Pennsylvania countless times. For analysis, we turn to Dr. Paul Kengor, professor of political science at Grove City College and a contributor to the National Catholic Register. Dr. Kengor, it is great to have you back. You're based in Pennsylvania, and Republicans there are doing well this election season. What were the issues most important to voters there, and is this success a surprise?
Yeah, hi, Monse. Well, so I was born in Pittsburgh, and I'm actually from Butler, Pennsylvania, if you can believe that. You know, we're now infamous or famous in Butler, however you want to put it. I teach at Grove City College, which is about a 25-minute drive from Butler. So I'm really right in the heart of this. Fracking was a major issue. The economy was a major issue. And I got to say, you know, on this show, from a Catholic perspective, it looks like Donald Trump won Catholics in the state of Pennsylvania by probably about 14 or 15 points. And nationally, there's an NBC News poll. There's also a Washington Post poll. He may have won Catholics by as much as 58 to 40%. And I got to tell you, that's quite stunning. Typically, the Catholic vote will kind of, because the Catholics are so broad a group, it typically mirrors the overall vote in the country, which in this election would be like 51-48. It went a little more for Trump. It might be maybe 52 for Trump, 53. But to see him getting like 58% of the Catholic vote is really remarkable. And you would really have to say that it's Roman Catholics that elected Donald Trump in 2024.
Right. Well, you did write about this in the National Catholic Register. What is it then that motivated the Catholic vote in this way?
Yeah, I think it was issues like abortion, moral, sexual, social, cultural issues. I mean, LGBTQ stuff, same-sex marriage, quote unquote, gender transitioning, some of the radical gender ideology. And also, too, Donald Trump showed himself very open to Catholics, not just from 2017 and 2021 when he was president. But I mean, look at the Al Smith dinner, right? He went there in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. They smiled together. They laughed together. They broke bread together. This time, Kamala Harris didn't go. And she had a record back in California pursuing David DeLayden when David DeLayden tried to expose Planned Parenthood's fetal parts business. And when she was on the Senate Judiciary Committee before she was vice president, she went after U.S. District Court Judge Nebraska Brian Boichert for being a member of the Knights of Columbus,
right.
which she described as this all-male Catholic society that was anti-choice. So she really showed lack of knowledge and ignorance about Catholics. And a lot of Catholics saw her as hostile, faithful Catholics, to the issues that she holds dear. And also, I must say this, Donald Trump did really well among Latinos, probably 40 to 45%, not a majority, but that's way higher than he got in 2016, 2020. And Latinos are Catholic. They're mostly devoted Catholics, especially in states like Florida. In Florida, it looks like Trump might have won the Catholic vote by 29%.
It was certainly
staggering numbers.
It was a big deal. Well, thank you so much for this analysis. And I know that we'll be hoping that everyone will read your piece in the National Catholic Register. Thank you so
much. Thanks, Matze. Sure thing.
And some good news from the Federal Reserve today.
Today, the FOMC decided to take another step in reducing the degree of policy restraint by lowering our policy interest rate by a quarter percentage point. We continue to be confident that with an appropriate recalibration of our policy stance, strength in the economy and the labor market can be maintained, with inflation moving sustainably down to 2%.
The quarter point cut to interest rates is welcome news for consumers. It provides Americans with further relief from the high cost of credit cards, auto loans, and other debt. Still to come on EWTN News Nightly, Silent No More. The bells of Notre Dame are not only back, an iconic piece of French history will be added to this collection. And election trends, the surprising voter bloc who helped push former President Trump to victory. Welcome back. Three states have voted to repeal amendments that define marriage as between a man and a woman. In a vote of 63% to 36, Colorado removed language in the state constitution that says marriage is, quote, only a union of one man and one woman. California supported removing the traditional definition of marriage from its state constitution by a 61% to 38% vote. The new amendment also includes the right to marry as a fundamental right in the state's constitution. Hawaii is still yet to call the results of the marriage amendment, but looks to pass with more than 90% of the vote in. The measure will repeal the legislature's power to limit marriage to one man and one woman. Greg Baylor, senior counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom, weighs in on the danger of these measures.
Removing the existing definition of marriage from the constitution of the state in and of itself is probably not particularly consequential in terms of things happening on the ground. The problem is, in states like California, in states like Hawaii, in addition to removing existing language, they are adding a, quote, fundamental right to marry. And that's where the danger comes in. That gives judges the authority to strike down any and all existing restrictions on marriage.
And reaction is pouring in following Donald Trump's victory in the 2024 election. And one of the emerging trends is the deep voting divide between single and married women. According to exit polling from NBC News, non-married women voted for Vice President Kamala Harris by 59% to 38%. Married women voted for President-elect Donald Trump by 51% to 48%. For analysis, we turn to Brad Wilcox, professor of sociology and director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. Brad, it's great to have you back. We've been watching your analysis on X and this huge divide between the voting of single women and married women in the 2024 election. What do you attribute that to, and was it surprising for you?
Yeah, well, we've basically seen that there's kind of been a growing ideological divide between young women and young men, where a lot of young men sort of turned hard to the left in the wake of the Great Awakening, 2014 era, obviously. And then more recently, a lot of younger men have felt kind of like they're alienated from both the system and then from kind of democratic messaging and have turned to the right. What's striking is that they moved 14 percentage points, you know, to the right in this most recent election. So it's just a major turn for young men away from the Democratic Party.
Wow, the great awakening. That's a new one for me. Well, Brad, you also noted that the marriage gap was just as big as the gender gap, where women were more likely than men to vote for the Harris ticket. Married people were more likely to support the Trump ticket. Is this unusual for married individuals to lean conservative?
You know, it's not unusual, but it is striking. All the sort of discussion that I heard was about the gender gap. And the gender gap in basically in Trump support was 10 percentage points. It was 11 percentage points when it comes to the married versus the unmarried gap. So it just kind of tells us that what matters for people is not just their gender, but also their marital status. And both married men and married women in the United States voted by majority for Donald Trump. So that's, I think, you know, a noteworthy pattern. I think it connects to the fact that they're more likely to sort of see the Republican Party as more family friendly in some important respects than the Democratic Party today.
And it matters to them whether they can put food on the table, for sure. On social media, you highlighted a post that says U.S. states with high fertility rates voted heavily for President-elect Donald Trump, according to adding this reason that he nearly won New Jersey. Tell us more about this. And is it something we should keep our eye on for future elections?
Yeah, you know, a lot of advocates and scholars think that blue state policies are more kind of congenial for families. But we're seeing today, both in terms of migration, families leaving from one state to the next, and also in terms of the fertility rate, that red states kind of lead out as both places where people are moving to when it comes to moving their families and also when it comes to their fertility rates. So the top 10 fertility rate states are all red states, and the bottom 10 fertility rate states are all blue states. Just kind of just tells us there's something about red state America now that seems to be more congenial to families, both when it comes to moving and when it comes to having more kids as well.
That's right. Well, Brad, quickly, any final thoughts on this pro-family vote this election?
Yeah, so I think the big question, obviously, is whether or not this kind of interest on the part of many pro-family folks in Republicans will translate into a more generous child tax credit in the spring, as well as fixing what's called the marriage penalty, facing a lot of working class families, and then finally kind of doing something to bring the cost of housing, especially, I think, down. And we're hoping to see Congress and the new administration move forward on all three of those family policy items in 2025.
A lot of people certainly are looking at J.D. Vance as their advocate for those policies. Thank you so much, Professor Brad Wilcox from the University of Virginia.
Thank you.
Now to the Middle East. Tehran is facing new challenges as Iranian currency falls to an all-time low following the U.S. election. This comes as Iranians are divided on what Donald Trump's next presidency might bring. Iran's new president says he is open to talks with the president-elect. Now to Germany, where the coalition government has collapsed and there are calls for early elections. The three-party government collapsed when Chancellor Olaf Scholz fired his finance minister. The chancellor accused the minister of breaking trust and publicly calling for a different economic policy. This is expected to trigger a general election in Germany early next year. Israel is widening its offensive against Hezbollah, striking dozens of sites in north and south Lebanon. Officials report the bombardment killed dozens of people. The mayor of Baalbek said some of the strikes had targeted his historic city, which is home to one of the world's best preserved Roman ruins. One of the attacks hit a building that was 250 years old, dating back to the Ottoman era. Dozens of Lebanon's parliament members sent an urgent message to UNESCO calling for the protection of the country's heritage. Russia unleashes near-constant drone attacks on Ukrainian cities. President Zelensky says Moscow is launching roughly 10 times more drones than it did last fall. Russia launched a massive attack on Ukraine's capital earlier today. Local officials say the drones were coming, quote, in waves from different directions. Russia is also using fake drones without explosives to trick Ukraine's air defense systems. It makes Ukraine shoot down decoys, leaving the real drones free to attack. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a piece of advice from the Holy Father. The one thing he told a group of religious sisters never to lose. Plus, it has a nice ring to it. One of the world's best-known cathedrals takes another step toward reopening. Welcome back. The Holy Father reminds the faithful that holiness is always joyful. In a meeting with an order of religious sisters from Spain, the Holy Father called on all of the priests and nuns to not lose their joy nor their sense of humor. The sisters were celebrating the 450th anniversary of their convent. The Holy Father also met with seminarians from Spain, urging them to remain close to their bishops. Here in the United States, this is National Vocation Awareness Week. The annual celebration is a time to learn more about the many forms of religious life. At least some of the time, it can be pretty sweet. That was the Daughters of Mary of Nazareth from the Archdiocese of Boston. Recently, the sisters traveled to Georgia to help those affected by Hurricane Helene. And Mother Olga of the Sacred Heart, the founder and servant mother of the Daughters of Mary of Nazareth, joins us now here in studio. Mother Olga, it's such a blessing to have you here with us. As we mentioned, your sisters, the Daughters of Mary of Nazareth, were just in Georgia helping with this recovery from the hurricane. What made you go there?
So originally, we were invited by the pastor of St. Michael Church on Tybee Island, Father Brett Brennan, to help with the mission of evangelization in his parish. But then after, when the hurricane happened, a lot of people started going to the Tybee Island because it was one of the places that got electricity earlier than other places in Georgia and other parts of the country who were so impacted by the hurricane. So we end up going for 8 days mission and going door to door, reaching out to people, checking on their loved ones and their families. And we met a lot of people who have fled their homes because they lost everything. Like we met a couple who their home was completely destroyed. And when we invited them to come to the church and to pray with them during adoration and healing service, they said this was what we needed really the most, to find hope in this time of destruction. So it was really very powerful week. The whole week we went door to door, we went to different even stores and businesses and restaurants. We encountered people who were cleaning the roads and clearing, you know, the debris from, you know, the storm and from hurricane. And we end up visiting with the workers on the road, even the police and the firefighters who were helping with the aftermath of the hurricane. It was really such a privilege to be with them and to pray with them and to really help them to find hope when, you know, was such a difficult time. Because in these kind of disasters or even tragedies, sometimes people are vulnerable and, you know, they question, is God still with us, you know, in midst of this? So we were literally and physically there with them to assure them that God was watching over them and providing for them.
And that's really what you do when you're on mission as sisters. Yes. You're sharing Christ with the world. In your name, the Daughters of Nazareth, why that Nazarene spirituality?
So originally, the discernment for the foundation began really almost like 18 years ago with Cardinal Sean when he was a newly Archbishop of Boston. As you know, he came during a very difficult time in the life of the church in general, and especially the life of the church in Boston. So he wanted a new religious order in Boston to be, the way that he put it, to be the mother face of the church for those who were hurting and those who were, you know, suffering because of the scandal. And as, you know, I prayed about it and discerned and, you know, studied a lot about different religious orders and, you know, the history of religious life in America, I felt we needed to go back to the basics, to go back to simple ways of, you know, introducing, you know, faith and connecting people to God. And that is when Nazareth came to me through St. Charles de Foucault, the spirituality and the ministry of presence. the discernment began during a time when a lot of people were leaving the church. So I told Cardinal Sean, if we begin with the life of Nazareth and create a small Nazareth wherever we go in every neighborhood or places that we visit, it's almost like if people are not coming to the church, we want now the church to go to them.
Yes.
And we were able to do that through the spirituality of St. Charles and the life of Nazareth.
Well, you've certainly been mother to the people of Boston and mother to so many wonderful women that we invite to join you and to try to discover if they have a heart for Jesus and want to walk as a sister as well. This is Mother Olga of the Sacred Heart. Finally, tonight, Notre Dame Cathedral is ready to ring in a new milestone in its years-long restoration.
Ta bénédiction sur ces cloches.
The well-known cathedral received three new bells, one of which rang during the 2024 Paris Olympics. They were consecrated by a priest using holy water and three branches. The new bells will be installed above the altar, out of the view of the congregation, and will be rung at the moment during Mass when the priest consecrates the bread and wine, which become the body and blood of Christ. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Montse Alvarado. Good night, and God bless you.